Good evening and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast, episode 132. I am your guest host, Andrew Gibney, and with me, as always, the stalwarts of the podcasting world. We've got Terry DeFellin and Graeme Sibley. Evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Good evening, Andrew, and welcome back.
Great to be back. Absolute honour to be back. I don't know what number of show it was I was on before. I have no idea. I should have researched that, but you know.
Yeah, so should we.
Ooh, so should we. We should keep count of this sort of thing.
I think it might have been 75, 76, 77, because it was around when...
75, 76, 75.
What did you say? 75, 76. Yeah, it was something around
75.
That. 75. Yeah, Steve, stop singing. Something like so, that. It was so, just, 75 was the one that Richard Whittle was on. And, and you were on around that time because it was when Chris was off in New Zealand, as he is now. But now he's temporarily off in New Zealand.
But now he's permanently out
there.
Yeah.
Does that mean I come back for episode 200 now, is that?
Why not?
Yeah,
why
probably.
Not? Why the bloody hell not, eh? I think it's probably fair to say we'll still be here for episode 200.
It's a scary thought, but
we hope so.
Not
hope
really
so.
That scary nowadays, is it?
Yeah.
But we're here to talk about football. Finlay, basically, football. Well, this last week, gentlemen, we saw one of probably the greatest goals ever scored. Not talking about anything Crystal Palace or Arsenal did. We're talking about Zlatan Ibrahimovic, one of his many goals against England, the fourth one to be specific, the audacious overhead kick, which just in one field swoop summed up the man, I think, that we've all seen in the Champions League and through his many championship seasons. Now, there's been a lot of talk, guys, that this has been the greatest goal of all time, not to hype it up or anything, but first of all, is it the greatest goal of all time? And if not, what makes the greatest goal? Is it a one-off movement? Is it a flowing team move like Brazil in the 1970s? Graham, go to you first. What makes a worldie, as we'll call it?
I don't know. It's got to be something that really just you have never seen before. It's not like, you know, last season, the season before last, when Wayne Rooney scored his overhead kick, and it was thought, oh, this was fantastic, and it was a great goal. It was at a great time and a great match, but it was nothing you hadn't seen before, you know, not very often, but you had seen this sort of stuff before, and it was a bit of a shinner as well.
It was a shinner.
There was a striker in the French league who scored one very similar in around the same time, was there not, Andrew?
There was Jimmy Briand.
It was
against,
Jimmy Briand, yes.
Against Nancy, I think it was on a Friday night, if memory serves right, and yeah, scored an absolute... I think he didn't even shin it as well, he actually...
That one wasn't a shinner. Yeah. I would say that was probably a better executed goal than.
I think as well in the international goal of the season award, wasn't it up against a goal scored in the Northern Irish
league? Yeah,
yes, it was like a back heel overhead kick sort of. Yeah, that was.
Yeah. Which was utterly spectacular.
I wonder if the league that the goal scored in has something to do with it. Obviously, exposure matters. Not everyone was watching Bet365 or any other betting sites watching Jimmy Briand score, but then millions of people watch Wayne Rooney, and that's the one that gets all the attention.
I think, yeah. I mean, it also as well, it's the player as well, because when Wayne Rooney does it, it's seen as something spectacular and something that you are waiting for him to do. The following season, when Peter Crouch did his chest volley straight up into the top corner from miles out, everyone said, "Oh yeah, that got the term worldie, which was meant in a derogatory tempt of him of basically hitting hope."
Yeah,
I suppose if you measure a class goal by your preconceptions about the quality and skill and technique of the player.
Yeah.
So if it's Wayne Rooney, it's like, oh, it's completely like 90% meant that, and you know that's what he can do. Yeah. If it's Peter Crouch, it's like, oh, we completely 20% meant that because actually he's not that good, so he was a bit lucky. And like the no-mark from Northern Ireland, apologies, I don't remember his name, but it was a cracking goal. But I'm certain that everybody else would have thought, well, you know, it's a one in a million. He's never going to score a goal like that, even in practice.
I suppose the thing is as well is when Danny Welbeck scored that.
The goal against Sweden.
Against Sweden, yeah, when he's caught that one with the inside of his foot. Yeah.
He never meant that. You can't have that.
Yeah, he never meant that. Well, but he did it again.
It's interesting. interesting, yeah, because I mean, a lot of, I read somewhere someone was saying that that was a thing about the difference between being at a match and not being at a match, is that the, generally speaking, the television audience saw the Welbeck goal as maybe a bit of a fluke, but that apparently in the stadium there was no one had any doubts that it was that he knew exactly what he was doing and it was a cracking goal.
I mean,
suppose that leads us. Sorry, Andrew, go on.
No, I was going to say, goals are always better when you're there in person, though, aren't you? Even the simplest goal. I remember Chris Sutton scored against Juventus at Celtic Park. I think it put Celtic 3-2 up against Juventus, and the whole place erupted. It was like the most passion I've ever seen at a kind of live game. But it was just a kind of regular. We probably see two or three every weekend, but it was special because you were there. And I wonder, because you saw, was it Steven Gerrard and was it Osman said that that was the best goal? Zlatan's goal was the best goal they've ever seen live.
Yeah.
So I think that always has something to do with it when you actually witness it in person. When you're watching it on YouTube or you see a clip, it's like, well, it's good, but you've not got that emotion and the passion of being there. It definitely, I think, puts it in a different category altogether.
Oh, I think definitely, very much so. I mean, there's oftentimes you've been at a game and you've seen a goal. That goal is utterly brilliant. Yeah. And then by the time you watch it on Match of the Day, you thought, it was okay. It looked a lot better when I was there.
I mean, Terry, what's the best goal you've ever seen in person?
Oh, I was just thinking about that, actually, funnily enough, while you were there. I mean, most of the best goals that I've ever seen probably in person would be involving Crystal Palace, because that's overwhelmingly the most, the team that I've seen the most play. And I would have to go back quite some way. I remember Ian Wright's second against Wimbledon at Plough Lane before they moved out. Was a chest off the chest and volley from, I would say, about 30 yards out. I think probably the one, I don't know, there's quite a few, I'll be careful not to get too carried away. I'll name just two more.
Okay.
Gareth Southgate, two seasons later than that, in the first division against Portsmouth, where he started from the right back spot and then continued up the field, beat half the Portsmouth team and then rifled the ball home with an absolute stunner from about 25 yards. And I'll never forget that, because he had he'd left, we were like maybe 3-0 up at that point. He'd left the Portsmouth players for dead, and on either of his flanks there was Chris Armstrong and Paul Williams, and people of a certain vintage will know that those guys were many things, but they were very good finishers. And we were pleading with Southgate, who had a reputation for skying these kind of shots.
Which people would know about, sooner or later.
Yeah, indeed. And we were pleading with him to lay the ball off to one of these two players so they could then finish the job, and he didn't. And it went in, and he scored, and everyone just went insane. And it wasn't just because it was a very good, very exciting goal, starting from the very back of the field right to the very front, but simply because it was Southgate, and nobody quite believed it. I imagine it would be like watching John Jensen score in the day. You know, just
unlikely goals.
Fantastic goals from unlikely sources.
That is actually my goal that I'm going to mention is John Jensen's goal against QPR. yes, I was there when Johnny scored, and this is another case of it when you're seeing it, when you were seeing it there, you thought it was one of the most amazing goals you've ever seen, and yet really it was, you know, it was a nicely taken goal from about what?
But it wasn't a worldie.
No, but it was just a very, very nicely done goal. But it was more the celebrations.
What about you,
even though we lost it 3-1.
What about you, Gibbs? I mean, is it that goal from Chris Sutton? You reckon was probably the best one you've seen. You've been far and few. I mean, you didn't mention Nuri Sahin's goal against Wolfsburg, did you?
It was just
to wind up the fact that I was in the stadium, but I was getting the beer at the time.
I'm trying to think of all my trips to France. What really good goals I've seen, and I think I'm being quite unfortunate so far that there's been really a lack of really good goals. To be fair, I've not seen Leo win yet, which kind of I wouldn't mind seeing first, but probably Lisandro Lopez in September when I went for my birthday. It was like 35 yards out and he hadn't had a touch of the ball all game and just rifled it straight at one of those kind of swerves out past the post and back in, and just like there was some swear words said for that. Remember, that was a really good goal. Probably the best one was Henrik Larsson against Rangers in an Old Firm derby. He'd got some stick because he gave John Hartson a penalty at Kilmarnock, so I didn't want to take it. he was getting a lot of sticky, but he's not. He's lost his bottle, and he sort of took this ball on the turn, the edge of the box, and just on his right foot, swiveled it into the top corner. And my dad went. My dad found him like 5-6 rows down the stand. Everyone was going crazy. Just an absolute sweet finish from a player who was under a bit of criticism in the press. So that was a really good goal. I mean, we spoke about. I'm going to say John Jensen and yeah, Gareth Southgate. Obviously, not the best players in the world. Henrik Larsson, maybe up there. I mean, talk about worldy goals. What makes world class players? How do we define who is world class? At I always put it as if you're making a sort of world 11 with subs, would you get in it? Which sort of limits your options. But a lot of people put there's like 6, 7, 8 world class strikers. Yeah. Are they world class? I mean, what? Terry Graham, what makes a world-class player? What puts you on that pedestal at the top?
I think context is a big issue with world-class players. Is being able to do it when it really counts, when in the really really big games. I think that you can have all the technique in the world, but if for some reason you can't make it count when it absolutely matters, if you go away and you hide when it really matters, then that probably just keeps you out of that kind of elite. I would suggest to you that guys that fall into that category are the obvious ones: Cristiano Ronaldo, obviously Leo Messi. I would put Raul in that category as well.
Yeah,
as a player who produces the goods when required. I think that I mean, obviously, yes, you've got to be really good footballer, duh. You know, and you have to be really good in the position that you do. You've also got to have, I think, you know, the team spirit attributes, the ability to, and the willingness to help out. And you know, a lot of people sort of like, you know, have a go at English football for playing up those virtues. But when you're looking at the whole package of what is a world-class player, that's got to be in there as well, the commitment and the belief in the team and the understanding that football is a team game and not a game for individuals.
Yeah, it's got to be part of the package, but there's a lot of, I think what the British press get is if you're a hard worker and you work really hard and you give your all, that's enough. Where to me, that's a standard you should have. That should be the sort of basic you have, and then the skills and all the other ability comes after.
Certainly,
that.
But there is also another British belief that of liking someone who's flamboyant, who just turns up and does something magical. They're often mistrusted, but they're often seen as talismanic as well, aren't they?
Yes, even today that persists. I mean, that is something that's been going on since the 1970s, I'd say, with players like Frank Worthington, and to a lesser extent. Well, no, not to a lesser extent at all. And Rodney Marsh, of players who have an image of being, these were phenomenally talented players, but had this reputation for not being hard workers and perhaps not showing the kind of spirit that you'd expect. Matt Letizier was accused of the same thing, and it persists now. I mean, Dimitar Berbatov, for instance, is a mind-numbingly good player, and even at 32 is probably too good for Fulham, with apologies for them. He could be, you know, perhaps at a better club, and certainly could have done a lot more with his career at Manchester United, but that is still, you still get that. And even with managers, you get that. I was listening to Sunday Supplement this morning and they were still obsessing about how managers behave on the touchline. Still, it's 2012 and people are still going on about how they behave on the touchline. I've spent 5 minutes obsessing about how Andre Villas-Boas does the crouching thing and what's that all about. So really, who cares? Anyway,
focusing on his notebook.
But I mean, like, you know, what does it matter? It's not important. You know, what's important is what's going on the pitch. It's extraordinary how that persists. But I don't know whether or not you'd ever say that Frank Worthington, for instance, was a world-class player because maybe he didn't have that. But George Best, for instance, most people would argue was a world-class player, but of course never played in a World Cup because of his nationality.
Yeah.
And was he, I guess, is the answer.
There's a lot of weight to put on that about Lionel Messi, who anyone would say he's one of the greatest players of all time. He's up there in the Pele-Maradona conversation, but people still hark back, well, he's not won a World Cup. And, well, it's not his fault if the rest of the team aren't up to the same standard as him. It's not. If he doesn't win a World Cup, does he then fail as a player? I really don't think so.
And he's a Champions League winner as well, isn't he?
Is the Champions League now sort of going above the World Cup as the thing to win? If you've won the Champions League, does it put you in the same bracket as a World Cup winner? Because everything, it's every year, not every 4 years, but it's still a very hard competition to win.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a kind of competition that as the game has globalised and there's more and more players have gone into European football from the rest of the world, that it, in many respects it will replace the World Cup for some of those players because they're not likely to have much international success for the country that they play in. I do wonder about to what extent that's something that the Belgian and maybe the Swiss players will suffer from, you know, in the future, that they'll think, well, I suppose glory is in the Champions League for me, it's not in the World Cup. Belgium might do well in the World Cup, but they're not going to win it.
Yeah.
And certainly that would be the case with a lot of the very, very promising young Swiss players.
I suppose people like George Weah was like the first in the modern era players like that who could only ever see worldwide renown in competitions like the Champions League.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because Liberia would never get to the World Cup.
It's the same with Ryan Giggs is the obvious example. Obviously, it was never going to get anywhere for Wales, but has done amazingly well in the Champions League and deserves to be one of the sort of greatest Premier League players probably of all time. Whereas you get people like standard English players like. Has Lampard and Gerrard really done it at the highest level?
You could actually say, look at Paul Scholes, who gave up his England career more than 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So missing out on two World Cup.
But I would argue that Paul Scholes is a world-class player, or was a world-class player.
Yeah, it was.
Certainly.
If he hadn't been suspended for the Champions League final in 1999, he would have won his own Champions League medal.
Yeah.
And he's certainly got enough Premier League titles to demonstrate that. And yeah, I mean, the tragedy is that he quit. Well, from an England fan point of view, he quit too early. Obviously, from his point of view, he did what he thought was the best thing to do. But I think he was a linchpin in that England 98 World Cup side, which I happen to think was probably one of England's better World Cup sides and international sides. That team was a really, really good one, and if we hadn't been a little bit unfortunate in that second round game against Argentina, we would have gone a little bit further than that. And I thought Paul Scholes played a big part in that team.
I suppose you look at now how Manchester United also brought him back after retirement. He's still doing the business and probably staved off buying a really expensive player for another couple of years, which shows I think with that sort of player you can be in the late 30s and still produce at a really high level. Remember, Lubomir Mravčić came to Celtic when he bought 37, and we're all thinking, he came from Duisburg, Terry. And you're like, who is this guy? Never heard of him. And he was just phenomenal because his brain was there and his feet were still there. He had no pace, but he still turned it on to a level that we hadn't seen at Celtic Park for a long time. Terry, you mentioned also teams like Belgium and Switzerland teams like that. What about Germany themselves? Obviously, Germany, big fan of the Bundesliga yourself. They've got players in that team where you think, if you weren't playing for Germany, would you be lauded as Miroslav Klose is the one I'm getting at? What, going to become one of the all-time greatest World Cup strikers? But then, has he really ever done it really in the Bundesliga? Not as far as I can remember. He's not really been. He's a bit of an anomaly that you think he's done it at so many World Cups, but not really anywhere else.
He's got a reputation for being more of a national team player than he has a club player. But, I mean, unfortunately, I don't have his goal-scoring record in my brain. But they are actually more impressive than you would think. He scored a lot of goals for Bremen and then on for Bayern when he played for Bayern, although what tended to happen to him is he got kind of moved aside a little bit.
I just happened to have the stats here, Terry. Plucked them out of there. 53 goals in 89 games for Werder Bremen, which is a phenomenal record.
That's decent, yeah.
24 and 98 for Bayern, which...
Yeah, that's not so good.
And Lazio 20 and 39, which is a really good record.
But he scored some big goals in for Lazio, though, don't he? I mean, he scored some goals in the Rome derby, if I'm not mistaken.
That's always the way they were closer, isn't it? Like if you do need a goal in a big game. And this is a thing about someone who has got a reputation that is perhaps bigger than some of his performances would actually suggest, because whenever the world's watching, he seems to perform.
Yeah, whereas, conversely, and going back to the original subject, the perception persists in the UK that Zlatan.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of that is based on just simply people watching him at the time that he happens to be on, and maybe he's not playing quite as well as he usually does. Whereas, conversely, Closer is nowhere near as good a player as Zlatan, and yet just seems to just pop up and score goals. Yeah, you know, the good thing about Closer is that even when he was a clumsy young man, and he was, his instinct for goal is phenomenal. But obviously, over the years, he's actually grown into a very, very complete, very good, well-rounded striker.
I think there's some people make a lot of opinions over seeing a player maybe on the odd Champions League Tuesday or Wednesday, and not week in, week out, as Bundesliga for yourselves, like Ligue 1 for myself, and you make an opinion over 2-3 games, which is never enough to judge any player on, because your reputation, as you said, then precedes them. What you've heard and what you've heard of, that's what comes in. I think this is the first season that I've saw Zlatan sort of week in, week out. Some bits and bobs, Serie A, bits and bobs, Ajax, but this in... The record speaks for itself. PSG have played 4 games without him and haven't won any of those 4 games. Even after only 10 games, they've become so dependent on Zlatan and the way that everything goes through him. And he is now Paris Saint-Germain, which you think they've spent, 250 million euros in 2 seasons. It really shouldn't be, but I think that's more towards the player himself rather than PSG's sort of misgivings in what they can do. He's a phenomenon. I think that's the only way to describe it. And it's quite embarrassing, I think, to the British press that only now, because he scored 4 goals against England in a friendly, that he's now been accepted as being world-class, when he has been world-class since probably Juventus until Barcelona don't buy inferior players, do they? They buy the best. So, I mean, guys, from what you've saw of Zlatan, sort of club country, do you think he is world-class? Would you put him up there as world-class?
I suppose... when you answer that, you've got to ask, is he up there with Ronaldo and Messi? Is he, if you had all 3 of those in your team, you know, who would you leave out?
Ooh. Oh, well, I wouldn't leave out any of them.
You'd find a way.
Because Graham's playing 4, Graham put Vedic English playing 4-4-2 there.
I wouldn't play 4-4-2 with those guys. Yeah, I'd have Zlatan through the middle, and I'd have Messi and Ronaldo just tucked in behind them, supporting them. That's how I'd do it. And it would be the best team in the world. I think it's really difficult to call, but I think he's just below those two guys. But I would easily and happily accept any argument.
We are quite lucky at the moment to have quite so much talent around around like that.
Because
any other sort of period of you'd be looking at Ronaldo being the best player of the world.
Yeah, Ronaldo must kick himself to an extent, because he must think, well, I'd be like Pele now, or Maradona, if it wasn't for this Messi guy who's showing me up.
Because I think, as much as we put Messi and Ronaldo sort of together, I think everyone has Messi just slightly ahead of Ronaldo as well, don't they?
That's the general opinion, isn't it?
But I wonder to a certain extent whether that's because Messi just comes across as being a more likable guy.
Well, yes.
Doesn't have a face you just want to slap.
That's ridiculous. That's absurd. We're talking about football.
But that's how people base their decisions, isn't it, really?
Zlatan comes across as perhaps being a bit wacky and a bit arrogant.
Yeah.
Many people like that about him, but I think a lot of people, they don't see much humility in the way Zlatan is. Which, of course, I mean, it's just a one-dimensional perspective, just based on just what we see. I mean, none of us have met the guy. We don't know what he's truly like. We've heard some stories about, you know, in the dressing room, in the training ground, about the way he tends to carry himself around. Cristiano Ronaldo, again, has this thing, whereas Messi, because he's diminutive... And because he tends to ride challenges a little bit more, and he doesn't wind up opposition supporters, doesn't get England centre-forward sent off.
Yet. A little wink afterwards.
Because hopefully England will make it to 2014, so that you never know. He's just slightly elevated there. So perhaps, but I mean, maybe that's a question to ask, I guess, Andrew, is character, not just... his behaviour.
Is how you carry yourself.
Yeah. His dignity or conceptions of class. You know, I don't mean social
character,
class.
Isn't
I mean,
it?
Yeah, yeah. A part of being a world class player. Because you're you're not just a fantastic player, but you're a gentleman as well.
Yeah, if it is, then all the English players are in serious trouble.
I suppose it's going back to sort of the Pele-Maradona argument as well, because back in the day, Pele was the sort of clean-cut sort of guy. Maradona was the coke-snorting... that
guy who spent far too long in Naples, yeah.
Yeah, and that's the perception. I think a lot of people had Pele above Maradona because of that, but then there's the other side. There's the people who like Maradona because of what he did, the same way that people like Zlatan because of the way he is. I mean, he's... The guy, I mean, I've been going off PSG quite a lot since the whole QSI money thing. Never had a bad word against them. But it's like you don't like PSG, but you can't help but like Zlatan at the same time because of the audacious things that he'll try, the skill he's got, the aura he's got about him. And you, I'm drawn towards that sort of player. I think Messi's got that as well. He's quite quiet. But Ronaldo, he's not really got that. He's more just got the... I don't like him, and I'm Scottish. I should like him for getting Wayne Rooney sent off and doing all those things. But there's something that's not quite there if Ronaldo just think.
You wouldn't turn your back on him, would you?
No. And I suppose that I think that really does make part of the because the people that don't get in. You got Johan Cruyff. He's always there or thereabouts for the best player, but I think more as a manager, he's got not the best reputation of character. But I'm not sure, I'm a bit too young for him as a player. He's never quite there in the top bit of the argument. He's sort of below the sort of where Zlatan is, I suppose, below Messi and Ronaldo. He's below Pele and Maradona. So it's quite an interesting, I think that really does make.
Back in Cruyff's day, of course, international football, I still feel, was very much regarded as the pinnacle. Mm. Of course, he was part of that Dutch team that failed, got to the final in 74 and 78.
Against Beckenbauer's Germany.
Against Beckenbauer's Germany and Argentina and failed. Now, if we're talking about world-class players, then Franz Beckenbauer probably ticks all the boxes.
Of course. But would he have been in the UK brought down because he's German?
Well, they would have won because he's German, but also because he played in the 66 final, and so that failure would have stained him forever. if the level of media coverage and had been existence of football had existed in the 1960s and early 70s, then yes, I'm certain that Beckenbauer would have been regarded as he's good, but can he do it against the English clubs?
Can he do it in a cold Tuesday night in Stoke?
Yeah, but he wouldn't have been stoked back. I mean, it would have been stoked back.
Yes, actually, it would.
We're quicker running out of time, so before we go, let's sort of back to worldies. We'll go more to the present day. Graham Terry, who do we think is going to be the next player, either from the Bundesliga or the Premier League, to make it to that next level?
I'd love to say Jack Wilshere, but I don't think. I think he's going to plateau soon, and I think that we're probably going to see the best from him now. I don't think he's going to be. I don't think he's going to be someone who's going to be one of the greats. I think he's going to be as good as Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard in that respect.
Is that when he moves to Man City?
Hope so. Yeah. Hope so. Yeah. Then he's going really downhill. Yeah, then, like the rest of them do.
I mean, I have to go for my boy Eden Hazard. I think he's shown very quickly how much he's settled in England, which a lot of people put question marks over. And I can just see Chelsea being the stepping stone to something bigger, and I can see him maybe gets to sort of 26, 27 being in that conversation.
He's a lovely player, Eden Hazard.
I think
he's all right. Chelsea, says the Arsenal fan.
Chelsea scum.
I'll be shockingly biased and chuck a couple of names. The two guys fighting for that central position behind Lewandowski in Borussia Dortmund, Royce and Götze. Götze is really looking like he's coming back into form. Actually,
is good.
Played really well on Saturday, and Royce just a few teething problems having moved from Gladbach, but I think Champions League audience is beginning to see what he's about. I think that either or both of those two are going to ascend. I'm also going to mention Shaqiri, the Swiss international Bayern Munich midfielder. He's a really good player. He's still quite young, so he's got just a little way to go. But goodness, I think he's got the potential to be world class.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, that time has flown by. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on the show this evening.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you.
Yes.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much for stepping in.
Yeah, and we will get you back before 200.
We'd like to get you. Yeah, we'd hopefully like to get you back before 200.
anytime, guys. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to the Sound of Football podcast, episode 132. Until next week, I'm sure there's another excellent special host guest. It's goodbye from me and goodbye from Terry and Graham.
Yes, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Find us online at sofpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at Sound of Football, or find us on Facebook at facebook.com/SoundOfFootball.